Side 16, It, by Stephen King, continuing on page 580. There wasn't even a sales clerk hanging out, a welcome adult to put a stop to things before they got entirely out of hand. He could hear the three dinosaurs of the apocalypse closing in now, and he simply couldn't run anymore. Each breath produced a deep hurting stitch in his left side. His eye fixed on a door which read, Emergency Exit Only. Alarm will sound. Hope kindled in his chest. Richie ran down an aisle crammed with Donald Duck Jack-in-the-Boxes, United States Army tanks made in Japan, Lone Ranger cap pistols, wind-up robots. He reached the door and slammed the push bar as hard as he could. The door opened, letting in cool mid-March air. The alarm went off with a strident bray. Richie immediately doubled back and dropped to his hands and knees in the next aisle over. He was down before the door could settle closed again. Henry Belch and Victor thundered into the toy department just as the door clicked shut and the alarm cut off. They raced for it, Henry in the lead, his face set and intent. A sales clerk finally appeared, coming on the run. He wore a blue nylon duster over a plaid sport coat of excruciating ugliness. The rims of his spectacles were as pink as the eyes of a white rabbit. Richie thought he looked like Wally Cox in his Mr. Peepers role, and he had to slam his traitor mouth into the fat part of his forearm to keep from screaming out gales of exhausted laughter. You boys, Mr. Peepers exclaimed, you boys can't go out there. That's an emergency exit. You, hey, you boys. Victor glanced at him a little nervously, but Henry and Belch never turned from their course, and Victor followed them. The alarm brayed again, longer this time, as they charged into the alley. Before it stopped clanging, Richie was on his feet and trotting back toward ladies' lingerie. You boys will be barred from the store, the clerk yelled after him. Looking back over his shoulder, Richie squealed in his granny grunt voice, Did anyone ever tell you you look just like Mr. Peeper's young man? And so he had escaped. And so he had finished up almost a mile from Freese's in front of City Center. And, he devoutly hoped, out of harm's way, at least for the time being. He was spent. He sat down on a bench just to the left of the Paul Bunyan statue, wanting only a little peace while he got himself back together. In a bit he would get up and head home, but for now it felt too good to just sit here in the afternoon sun. The day had opened in a cold, drizzly gloom, but now you could believe spring might actually be on the way. Farther up the lawn he could see the City Center marquee, which on that March day bore this message in large blue translucent letters. Hey teens, coming March 28th. The Ernie Woo Woo Ginsburg Rock and Roll Show. Jerry Lee Lewis, the Penguins, Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, Gene Vincent and the Blue Caps, Freddie Boom Boom Cannon. An evening of wholesome entertainment. That was a show Richie really wanted to see, but he knew there wasn't a chance. His mother's idea of wholesome entertainment did not include Jerry Lee Lewis telling the young people of America, we got chicken in the barn, whose barn, what barn, my barn. Nor, for that matter, did it include Freddie Cannon, whose Tallahassee lassie had a hi-fi chassis. She was willing to admit that she had done her share of screaming for Frank Sinatra, whom she now called Frankie the Snot, as a bobby soxer, but, like Bill Denbrough's mother, she was deaf on rock and roll. Chuck Berry terrified her, and she declared that Richard Penniman, better known to his teen and sub-teen constituency as Little Richard, made her want to barf like a chicken. This was a phrase for which Richie had never asked a translation. His dad was neutral on the subject of rock and roll and could perhaps have been swayed, but Richie knew in his heart that his mother's wishes would rule on this subject. Until he was 16 or 17, anyway, and by then his mother was firmly convinced the country's rock and roll mania would have passed. Richie thought Danny and the Juniors were more right on that subject than his mom. Rock and roll would never die. He himself loved it, although his sources were really only two, American Bandstand on Channel 7 in the afternoon, and WMEX out of Boston at night, when the air had thinned and the hoarse, enthusiastic voice of Arnie Ginsberg came wavering in and out like the voice of a ghost called up at a seance. The beat did more than make him happy. It made him feel bigger, stronger, more there. When Frankie Ford sang Sea Cruise, or Eddie Cochran sang Summertime Blues, Richie was actually transported with joy. There was power in that music, a power which seemed to most rightfully belong to all the skinny kids, fat kids, ugly kids, shy kids, the world's losers, in short. In it he felt a mad, hilarious voltage which had the power to both kill and exalt. He idolized Fats Domino, who made even Ben Hanscom look slim and trim, and Buddy Holly, who, like Richie, wore glasses, and Screaming Jay Hawkins, who popped out of a coffin at his concerts, or so Richie had been told, and the Dovells, who danced as good as black guys. Well, almost. He would have his rock and roll someday if he wanted it. He was confident it would still be there for him when his mother finally gave in and let him have it. But that would not be on March 28, 1958, or in 1959, or... His eyes had drifted away from the marquee, and then, well, then he must have fallen asleep. It was the only explanation that made sense. What had happened next could only happen in dreams. And now he was here again, a Richie Tozier who had finally gotten all the rock and roll he had ever wanted, and who had found, happily, that it still wasn't enough. His eyes went to the marquee in front of City Center and saw that, with a hideous kind of serendipity, those same blue letters spelled out, June 14th, Heavy Metal Mania. Judas Priest, Iron Maiden. Buy your tickets here or at any Ticketron outlet. Somewhere along the way, they dropped the wholesome entertainment line. But as far as I can tell, that's just about the only difference, Richie thought. And heard Danny and the Juniors, dim and distant, like voices heard down a long corridor coming out of a cheap radio. Rock and roll will never die. I'll dig it to the end. It'll go down in history. Just you watch, my friend. Richie looked back at Paul Bunyan, patron saint of Derry. Derry, which had come into being, according to the stories, because this was where the logs fetched up when they came downriver. There had been a time when, in the spring, both the Penobscot and the Kanduskeag would have been solid logs from one side to the other, their black bark hides glistening in the spring sun. A fellow who was fast on his feet could walk from Wally's Spa in Hell's Half Acre over to Rampers in Brewster. Rampers was a tavern of such horrible repute that it was commonly called the Bucket of Blood, without getting his boots wet over the third crossing of his rawhide laces. Or so it had been storied in Richie's youth, and he supposed there was a bit of Paul Bunyan in all such stories. Old Paul, he thought, looking up at the plastic statue. What you been doing since I've been gone? Made any new riverbeds coming home tired and dragging your axe behind you? Made any new lakes on account of wanting a bathtub big enough so you could sit in water up to your neck? Scared any more little kids the way you scared me that day? Ah, and suddenly he remembered it all. The way you will sometimes suddenly remember a word which has been dancing on the tip of your tongue. There he had been, sitting in that mellow March sunshine, drowsing a little, thinking about going home and catching the last half hour of bandstand, and suddenly there had been a warm swash of air into his face. It blew his hair back from his forehead. He looked up, and Paul Bunyan's huge plastic face had been right in front of his, bigger than a face on a movie screen, filling everything. The rush of air had been caused by Paul's bending down, although he did not precisely look like Paul anymore. The forehead was now low and beetling. Tufts of wiry hair poked from a nose as red as the nose of a long-time drunkard. His eyes were bloodshot, and one had a slight cast to it. The axe was no longer on his shoulder. Paul was leaning on its haft, and the blunt end of its head had crushed a trench in the concrete of the sidewalk. He was still grinning, but there was nothing cheery about it now. From between gigantic yellow teeth, there drifted a smell like small animals rotting in hot underbrush. "I'm going to eat you up," the giant had said in a low, rumbling voice. It was the sound of boulders rocking against each other during an earthquake. "Unless you give me back my hen and my harp and my bags of gold, I'm going to eat you right the fuck up." The breath of these words made Richie's shirt flutter and flap like a sail in a hurricane. He shrank back against the bench, eyes bugging, hair standing out to all sides like quills, wrapped in a pocket of carrion stink. The giant began to laugh. It settled its hands on the haft of its axe, the way Ted Williams might have laid hold of his favorite baseball bat, or ash handle if you prefer, and pulled it out of the hole it had made in the sidewalk. The axe began to rise into the air. It made a low, lethal, rushing sound. Richie suddenly understood that the giant meant to split him right down the middle. But he felt that he could not move. A logy sort of apathy had stolen over him. What did it matter? He was dozing, having a dream. Any moment now some driver would blow his horn at a kid running across the street and he would wake up. "That's right," the giant had rumbled. "You'll wake up in hell." and at the last instant, as the axe slowed to its apogee and balanced there, Richie understood that this wasn't a dream at all. And if it was, it was a dream that could kill. Trying to scream but making no sound at all, he rolled off the bench and onto the raked gravel plot which surrounded what had been a statue and was now only a base with two huge steel bolts sticking out of where the feet had been. The sound of the descending axe filled the world with its pressing, insistent whisper. The giant's grin had become a murderer's grimace. Its lips had pulled back so far from its teeth that its plastic red gums, hideously red, gleamed. The blade of the axe struck the bench where Richie had been only an instant before. The edge was so sharp that there was almost no sound at all, but the bench was sheared instantly in two. The halves sagged away from each other, the wood inside the green-painted skin a bright and somehow sickening white. Richie was on his back. Still trying to scream, he pushed himself with his heels. Gravel went down the collar of his shirt, down the back of his pants. And there was Paul, towering above him, looking down at him with eyes the size of manhole covers. There was Paul, looking down at one small boy cowering on the gravel. The giant took a step toward him. Richie felt the ground shudder when the black boot came down. Gravel spumed up in a cloud. Richie rolled over onto his stomach and staggered to his feet. His legs were already trying to run before he was balanced, and as a result he fell flat on his belly again. He heard the wind woof out of his lungs. His hair fell in his eyes. He could see the traffic going back and forth on Canal and Main Streets as it did every day, as if nothing was happening, as if no one in those cars could see or care that Paul Bunyan had come to life and stepped down from its pedestal in order to commit murder with an axe roughly the size of a deluxe motorhome. The sunshine was blotted out. Richie lay in a patch of shade that looked like a man. He scrambled to his knees, almost fell over sideways, managed to get to his feet, and ran as fast as he could. He ran with his knees popping almost all the way up to his chest and his elbows pistoning. Behind him, he could hear that awful, persistent whisper building again, a sound that seemed to be not really sound at all, but pressure on the skin and eardrums. Swip! The earth shook. Richie's upper and lower teeth rattled against each other like china plates in an earthquake. He did not have to look to know that Paul's axe had buried itself half deep in the sidewalk inches behind his feet. Madly in his mind, he heard the Dovells. Oh, the kids in Bristol are sharp as a pistol when they do the Bristol stomp. He passed out of the giant shadow into sunlight again, and as he did, he began to laugh, the same exhausted laughter that had come from him when he bolted downstairs in Freese's. Panting, that hot stitch in his side again, he had at last risked a glance back over his shoulder. There was the statue of Paul Bunyan, standing on its pedestal where it always stood, axe on its shoulder, head cocked toward the sky, lips parted in the eternal optimistic grin of the myth hero. The bench which had been sheared in two was whole and intact, thank you very much. The gravel where tall Paul, he's a my all, Annette Funicello sang maniacally in Richie's head, had planted his huge foot, was raked and immaculate, except for the scuffed spot where Richie had fallen off while he was getting away from the giant. Dreaming. There was no footprint, no axe slash in the concrete. There was nothing here but a boy who had been chased by other boys, bigger boys, and so had had himself a very small, but very potent, dream about a homicidal colossus. The giant economy-size Henry Bowers, if you pleased. Shit, Richie said in a tiny wavering voice, and then uttered an uncertain laugh. He stood there a while longer, waiting to see if the statue would move again, perhaps wink, perhaps shift its axe from one shoulder to the other, perhaps come down and have at him again. But of course none of those things happened. Of course. What, me worry? Hardy har har har. A doze, a dream, no more than that. But, as Abraham Lincoln or Socrates or someone like that had once observed, enough was enough. It was time to go home and cool out, to make like Kooky on 77 Sunset Strip and just lay chilly. And although it would have been quicker to cut through the city center grounds, he decided not to. He didn't want to get close to that statue again. So he had gone the long way around, and by that evening he had nearly forgotten the incident. Until now. Here sits a man, he thought. Here sits a man dressed in a mossy green sport coat purchased at one of the best shops on Rodeo Drive. Here sits a man with Bass Weegans on his feet and Calvin Klein underwear to cover his ass. Here sits a man with soft contact lenses resting easily on his eyes. Here sits a man remembering the dream of a boy who thought an Ivy League shirt with a Fruit Loop on the back and a pair of Snapjack shoes was the height of fashion. Here sits a grown-up looking at the same old statue. And hey, Paul, tall Paul, I'm here to say you're the same in every way. You ain't aged a motherfucking day. The old explanation still rang true in his mind. A dream. He supposed he could believe in monsters if he had to. Monsters were no big deal. Hadn't he sat in radio studios at one time or another reading news copy about such fellows as Idi Amin Dada and Jim Jones, and that guy who had blown away all those folks in the McDonald's just down the road a piece? Sit fire and save matches. Monsters were cheap. Who needed a $5 movie ticket when you could read about them in the paper for 35 cents or hear about them on the radio for free? And he supposed if he could believe in the Jim Jones variety, he could believe in Mike Hanlon's version, at least for a while. It even had its own sorry charm, because it came from outside, and no one had to claim responsibility for it. He could believe in a monster that had as many faces as there are rubber masks in a novelty shop. If you're going to have one, you might as well have a pack of them, he thought. Cheaper by the dozen, right, gang? At least for the sake of argument. But a 30-foot-high plastic statue that stepped off its pedestal and then tried to carve you up with its plastic axe? That was just a little too ripe. As Abraham Lincoln or Socrates or someone had also said, I'll eat fish and I'll eat meat, but there is some shit I will not eat. It just wasn't... That sharp needling pain struck his eyes again without warning, jerking a dismayed cry from him. This was the worst yet, going deeper and lasting longer, scaring the bejesus out of him. He clapped his hands to his eyes and then groped instinctively for the bottom lids with his forefingers, meaning to pop his contacts out. It's maybe some kind of infection, he thought dimly, but Jesus, it hurts. He pulled the lids down and was ready to give the single practiced blink that would send them tumbling out, and he would spend the next 15 minutes groveling myopically for them in the gravel surrounding the bench, but Jesus God, who gave a shit? Right now it felt like there were nails in his eyes. When the pain disappeared... It did not dwindle. It just went. One moment there, the next moment gone. His eyes teared briefly and then stopped. He lowered his hands slowly, his heart running fast in his chest, ready to blink them out the instant the pain started again. It didn't. And suddenly he found himself thinking about the only horror movie that had ever really scared him as a kid, possibly because he had taken so much shit about his glasses and had spent so much time thinking about his eyes. The movie had been The Crawling Eye with Forrest Tucker. Not very good. The other kids had laughed themselves into hysterics over it. But Richie had not laughed. Richie had been rendered cold and white and dumb, for once with not a single voice to command, as that gelatinous tentacled eye came out of the manufactured fog of some English movie set, waving its fibrous tentacles in front of it. The sight of that eye had been very bad, the embodiment of 100 not-quite-realized fears and disquiets. On some night not long after, he had dreamed of looking at himself in a mirror and bringing a large pin up and sticking it slowly into the black iris of his eye and feeling a numb, watery springiness as the bottom of his eye filled up with blood. He remembered, now he remembered, waking up and discovering that he had wet the bed. The best indicator of how gruesome that dream had been was that his primary feeling had been not shame at his nocturnal indiscretion, but relief. He had embraced the warm, wet patch with his body and blessed the reality of his sight. Fuck this, Richie Tozier said in a low voice that was not quite steady, and started to get up. He would go back to the Derry townhouse and take a nap. If this was memory lane, he preferred the L.A. freeway at rush hour. The pain in his eyes was probably no more than a signal of exhaustion and jet lag, plus the stress of meeting the past all at once in one afternoon. Enough shocks, enough exploring. He didn't like the way his mind was skittering from one subject to the next. What was that Peter Gabriel tune? Shock the Monkey. Well, this monkey had been shocked enough. It was time to catch some Z's and maybe gain a little perspective. As he rose, his eyes went to the marquee in front of City Center again. All at once the strength ran out of his legs, and he sat down again. Hard. Richie Tozier, man of 1,000 voices, returns to Derry, land of 1,000 dances. In honor of Trash Mouth's return, City Center proudly presents the Richie Tozier All Dead Rock Show. Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, The Big Bopper, Frankie Lyman, Gene Vincent, Marvin Gaye, House Band, Jimi Hendrix, lead guitar. John Lennon, rhythm guitar. Phil Lynott, bass guitar. Keith Moon, drums. Special guest vocalist, Jim Morrison. Welcome home, Richie. You're dead, too. He felt as if someone had whopped all the breath out of him. And then he heard that sound again, that sound that was half pressure on the skin and eardrums, that keen, homicidal, whispering rush. Swep. He rolled off the bench onto the gravel, thinking, so this is what they mean by deja vu. Now you know. You'll never have to ask anybody again. He hit on his shoulder and rolled, looking up at the Paul Bunyan statue. Only it was no longer Paul Bunyan. The clown stood there instead, resplendent and evident, fantastic in plastic. 20 feet of day-glow colors, its painted face surmounting a cosmic comic ruff. Orange pom-pom buttons cast in plastic, each as big as a volleyball, ran down the front of the silvery suit. Instead of an axe, it held a huge bunch of plastic balloons. Engraved on each were two legends. It's Still Rock and Roll to Me, and Richie Tozier's All Dead Rock Show. He scrambled backward, using his heels and his palms. Gravel went down the back of his pants. He heard a seam tear loose in the underarm of his Rodeo Drive sport coat. He rolled over, gained his feet, staggered, looked back. The clown looked down at him. Its eyes rolled wetly in their sockets. "Did I give you a scare, my man?" it rumbled. And Richie heard his mouth say, quite independently of his frozen brain, "Cheap thrills in the back of my car, bozo, that's all." The clown grinned and nodded, as if it had expected no more. Red paint-bleeding lips parted to show teeth like fangs, each one coming to a razor point. "I could have you now if I wanted you now," it said, "but this is going to be too much fun." "Fun for me, too," Richie heard his mouth say. "The most fun of all when we come to take your fucking head off, baby." The clown's grin spread wider and wider. It raised one hand, clad in a white glove, and Richie felt the wind of the movement blow the hair off his forehead as it had on that day 27 years ago. The clown's index finger popped out at him. It was as big as a beam. Big as a bee, Richie thought, and then the pain struck again. It drove rusty spikes into the soft jelly of his eyes. He screamed and clutched at his face. "Before removing the mote from thy neighbor's eye, attend the beam in thine own," the clown intoned, its words rumbling and vibrating, and Richie was again enveloped in the sweet stink of its carrion breath. He looked up and took half a dozen hurried steps backward. The clown was bending down, its gloved hands on its gaily pantaloon knees. "Want to play some more, Richie? How about if I point at your pecker and give you prostate cancer? Or I could point at your head and give you a good old brain tumor, although I'm sure some people would say that would only be adding to what was already there. I can point at your mouth and your stupid flapping tongue will turn into so much running pus. I can do it, Richie. Want to see?" Its eyes were widening, widening, and in those black pupils, each as big as a softball, Richie saw the mad darkness that must exist over the rim of the universe. He saw a shitty happiness that he felt would drive him insane. In that moment he understood it could do any of these things and more. And yet again he heard his mouth, but this time it was not his voice or any of his created voices, past or present. It was a voice he had never heard before. Later he would tell the others, hesitantly, that it was a kind of Mr. Jive-Ass Nigger voice, loud and proud, self-parodying and screechy. "Get off my case, you big old honky clown," he shouted, and suddenly he was laughing again. "No shit and no shine, muffa. I got to walk, I got to talk, and I got the big boppin' cock. I got the time, I got the mind. I'm a man with a plan, and if you don't shit, you gon' get. You hear me, you white-faced bunghole?" Richie thought the clown recoiled, but he did not stick around to find out for sure. He ran, elbows pumping, sport coat flying out in wings behind him, not caring that a father who had stopped so his toddler could admire Paul was now staring warily at him, as if he had gone crazy. "As a matter of fact, folks," Richie thought, "I feel like I've gone crazy. Oh, God, do I ever." And that had to have been the shittiest Grandmaster Flash imitation in history. But somehow it did the trick, somehow. And then the clown's voice thundered after him. The father of the little boy did not hear it, but the toddler's face suddenly pinched in upon itself and began to wail. The dad picked his son up and hugged him, bewildered. Even through his own terror, Richie observed this little sideshow closely. The voice of the clown was perhaps angrily gleeful, perhaps just angry. "We've got the eye down here, Richie. You hear me?"
the one that crawls. If you don't want to fly, don't want to say goodbye, you come on down under this here town and give a great big hi to one great big eye. You come down and see it any time, just any old time you like. You hear me, Richie? Bring your yo-yo. Have Beverly wear a big full skirt with four or five petticoats underneath. Have her wear her husband's ring around her neck. Get Eddie to wear his saddle shoes. We'll play some bop, Richie. We'll play all the hits.
Reaching the sidewalk, Richie dared to look back over his shoulder. And what he saw was in no way comforting. Paul Bunyan was still gone. And now the clown was gone, too. Where they had stood, there was now a 20-foot-high plastic statue of Buddy Holly. He was wearing a button on one of the narrow lapels of his plaid sport coat. Richie Tozier's All Dead Rock Show, the button read. One bow of Buddy's glasses had been mended with adhesive tape. The little boy was still crying hysterically. His father was walking rapidly back toward downtown with the weeping child in his arms. He gave Richie a wide berth. Richie got walking. Feet, don't fail me now. Trying not to think about, we'll play all the hits, what had just happened. All he wanted to think about was the monster jolt of scotch he was going to have in the Derry Townhouse bar before he went up to take that nap. The thought of the drink, just your ordinary garden variety drink, made him feel a little better. He looked over his shoulder one more time, and the fact that Paul Bunyan was back, grinning at the sky, plastic axe over his shoulder, made him feel better still. Richie began to walk faster, making tracks, putting distance between himself and that statue. He had even begun to think about the possibility of hallucinations when the pain struck his eyes again, deep and agonizing, causing him to cry out hoarsely. A pretty young girl who had been walking ahead of him, looking dreamily up at the breaking clouds, looked back at him, hesitated, then hurried over. "Mister, are you all right?"
"It's my contacts," he said in a strained voice. "My damned contact lens. Oh, my God, that hurts."
This time he got his forefingers up so quickly he almost jabbed them into his eyes. He pulled down the lower lids and thought, "I won't be able to blink them out. That's what's going to happen. I won't be able to blink them out. And it's just going to go on hurting and hurting and hurting until I go blind, go blind, go blind." But one blink did it, as one blink always had. The sharp and defined world, where colors stayed inside the lines and where faces that you saw were clear and obvious, simply fell away. Wide bands of pastel fuzz took their place. And although he and the high school girl, who was both helpful and concerned, searched the paving of the sidewalk for almost 15 minutes, neither could find even a single lens. In the back of his head, Richie seemed to hear the clown laughing. 5. Bill Denbrough sees a ghost. Bill did not see Pennywise that afternoon, but he did see a ghost, a real ghost. So Bill believed then, and no subsequent event caused him to change his mind. He had walked up Witcham Street and paused for some time by the drain where George met his end on that rainy October day in 1957. He squatted down and peered into the drain, which was cut into the stonework of the curbing. His heart was beating hard, but he looked anyway.
"Come out, why don't you?" he said in a low voice, and he had the not-quite-mad idea that his voice was floating along dark and dripping passageways,
not dying out, but continuing onward and onward, feeding on its own echoes, bouncing off moss-covered stone walls and long-dead machinery. He felt it float over still and sullen waters and perhaps issue softly from 100 different drains in other parts of the city at the same time.
"Come out of there, or we'll come in and get you."
He waited nervily for a response, crouched down with his hands between his thighs like a catcher between pitches. There was no response. He was about to stand up when a shadow fell over him. Bill looked up sharply, eagerly, ready for anything. But it was only a little kid, maybe 10, maybe 11. He was wearing faded Boy Scout shorts which displayed his scabby knees to good advantage. He had a freeze pop in one hand and a fiberglass skateboard, which looked almost as battered as his knees, in the other. The freeze pop was a fluorescent orange. The skateboard was a fluorescent green.
"You always talk into the sewers, mister?" the boy asked.
"Only in Derry," Bill said. They looked at each other solemnly for a moment and then burst into laughter at the same time.
"I want to ask you a stupid question, Bill said.
"Okay," the kid said.
"You ever hear anything down in one of these?"
The kid looked at Bill as though he had flipped out.
"Okay," Bill said. "Forget I asked."
He started to walk away and had gotten maybe 12 steps. He was headed up the hill, vaguely thinking he would take a look at the home place, when the kid called, "Mister?" Bill turned back. He had his sport coat hooked on his finger and slung over his shoulder. His collar was unbuttoned, his tie loosened. The boy was watching him carefully, as if already regretting his decision to speak further. Then he shrugged, as if saying, "Oh, what the hell?"
"Yeah."
"Yeah?"
"Yeah." "What did it say?" "I don't know. It talked some foreign language. I heard it coming out of one of those pumping stations down in the Barrens. One of those pumping stations. They look like pipes coming out of the ground."
"I know what you mean. Was it a kid you heard?"
"At first it was a kid, then it sounded like a man."
The boy paused.
"I was some scared. I ran home and told my father. He said maybe it was an echo or something coming all the way down the pipes from someone's house."
"Do you believe that?" The boy smiled charmingly.
"I read in my Ripley's Believe It or Not book that there was this guy. He got music from his teeth. Radio music. His fillings were like little radios. I guess if I believed that, I could believe anything."
I Bill said. "But did you believe it?" The boy reluctantly shook his head. "Did you ever hear those voices again?"
"Once when I was taking a bath," the boy said. "It was a girl's voice. Just crying, no words. I was scared to pull the plug when I was done because I thought I might, you know, drown her."
Bill nodded again. The kid was looking at Bill openly now, his eyes shining and fascinated.
"You know about those voices, mister?"
"I heard them," Bill said, "a long, long time ago. Do you know any of the kids that have been murdered here, son?" The shine went out of the kid's eyes. It was replaced by caution and disquiet.
"My dad says I'm not supposed to talk to strangers. He says anybody could be that killer."
He took an additional step away from Bill, moving into the dappled shade of an elm tree that Bill had once driven his bike into 27 years ago. He had taken a spill and bent his handlebars.
"Not me, kid," he said. "I've been in England for the last 4 months. I just got into Derry yesterday."
"I still don't have to talk to you," the kid replied.
"That's right," Bill agreed. "It's a free country."
He paused and then said, "I used to pal around with Johnny Fury some of the time. He was a good kid. I cried,"
the boy finished matter-of-factly, and slurped down the rest of his freeze pop. As an afterthought, he ran out his tongue, which was temporarily bright orange, and lapped off his arm.
"Keep away from the sewers and drains," Bill said quietly. "Keep away from empty places and deserted places. Stay out of train yards, but most of all, stay away from the sewers and the drains."
The shine was back in the kid's eyes, and he said nothing for a very long time. Then,
"Mister, you want to hear something funny?"
"Sure."
"You know that movie where the shark ate all the people up?"
"Everyone does. Jaws.
Well, I got this friend, you know? His name's Tommy Vicinanza, and he's not that bright. Toys in the attic, you get what I mean?"
"Yeah."
"He thinks he saw that shark in the canal. He was up there by himself in Basie Park a couple of weeks ago, and he said he seen this fin. He says it was 8 or 9 feet tall. Just the fin was that tall, you get me? He goes, 'That's what killed Johnny and the other kids. It was Jaws. I know because I saw it.' So I go, 'That canal's so polluted, nothing could live in it, not even a minnow. And you think you saw Jaws in there? You got toys in the attic, Tommy.' Tommy says it reared right out of the water like it did at the end of that movie and tried to bite him. And he just got back in time. Pretty funny, huh, mister?"
"Pretty funny," Bill agreed.
"Toys in the attic, right?"
Bill hesitated.
"Stay away from the canal too, son. You follow?"
"You mean you believe it?"
Bill hesitated. He meant to shrug. Instead, he nodded. The kid let out his breath in a low, hissing rush. He hung his head as if ashamed.
"Yeah, sometimes I think I must have toys in the attic."
"I know what you mean." Bill walked over to the kid, who glanced up at him solemnly, but didn't shy away this time.
"You're killing your knees on that board, son."
The kid glanced down at his scabby knees and grinned.
"Yeah, I guess so. I bail out sometimes."
"Can I try it?" Bill asked suddenly. The kid looked at him, gape-mouthed at first, then laughing.
"That'd be funny," he said. "I never saw a grown-up on a skateboard."
"I'll give you a quarter," Bill said.
"My dad said,
'Never take money or candy from strangers. Good advice.' I'll still give you a quarter. What do you say? Just to the corner of Jackson Street."
"Never mind the quarter," the kid said. He burst into laughter again. a gay and uncomplicated sound, a fresh sound. I don't need your quarter. I got $2. I'm practically rich. I got to see this, though. Just don't blame me if you break something.
Don't worry, Bill said. I'm insured.
He turned one of the skateboard's scuffed wheels with his finger, liking the speedy ease with which it turned. It sounded like there was about 1,000,000 ball bearings in there. It was a good sound. It called up something very old in Bill's chest. Some desire as warm as want, as lovely as love. He smiled.
What do you think? The kid asked.
I think I'm gonna kill myself, Bill said, and the kid laughed. Bill put the skateboard on the sidewalk and put one foot on it. He rolled it back and forth experimentally. The kid watched. In his mind, Bill saw himself rolling down Witcham Street toward Jackson on the kid's avocado green skateboard, the tails of his sport coat ballooning out behind him, his bald head gleaming in the sun, his knees bent in that fragile way snow bunnies bend their knees their first day on the slopes. It was a posture that told you that in their heads they were already falling down. He bet the kid didn't ride the board like that. He bet the kid rode to beat the devil, like there was no tomorrow. That good feeling died out of his chest. He saw all too clearly the board going out from under his feet, shooting unencumbered down the street, an improbable fluorescent green, a color that only a child could love. He saw himself coming down on his ass, maybe on his back. Slow dissolve to a private room at the Dairy Home Hospital, like the one they had visited Eddie in after his arm had been broken. Bill Denbro in a full body cast, one leg held up by pulleys and wires. A doctor comes in, looks at his chart, looks at him, and then says, "You were guilty of 2 major lapses, Mr. Denbro. The first was mismanagement of a skateboard. The second was forgetting that you are now approaching 40 years of age." He bent, picked the skateboard back up, and handed it back to the kid. "I guess not," he said. "Chicken," the kid said, not unkindly. Bill hooked his thumbs into his armpits and flapped his elbows. "Buck, buck, buck," he said. The kid laughed. "Listen, I got to get home."
"Be careful on that," Bill said.
"You can't be careful on a skateboard," the kid replied, looking at Bill as if he might be the one with toys in the attic.
"Right," Bill said. "Okay, as we say in the movie biz, I hear you. But stay away from drains and sewers, and stay with your friends."
The kid nodded. "I'm right near home."
"So is my brother," Bill thought.
"It'll be over soon anyway," Bill told the kid.
"Will it?" the kid asked.
"I think so," Bill said.
"Okay. See you later, chicken."
The kid put one foot on the board and pushed off with the other. Once he was rolling, he put the other foot on the board as well and went thundering down the street at what seemed to Bill a suicidal pace. But he rode as Bill had suspected he would, with lazy, hip-shot grace. Bill felt love for the boy, an exhilaration, and a desire to be the boy, along with an almost suffocating fear. The boy rode as if there were no such things as death or getting older. The boy seemed somehow eternal and ineluctable in his khaki Boy Scout shorts and scuffed sneakers, his ankles sockless and quite dirty, his hair flying back behind him.
"Watch out, kid. You're not going to make the corner,"
Bill thought, alarmed. But the kid shot his hips to the left like a breakdancer, his toes revolved on the green fiberglass board, and he zoomed effortlessly around the corner and onto Jackson Street, simply assuming no one would be there to get in his way.
"Kid," Bill thought, "it won't always be that way."
He walked up to his old house, but did not stop. He only slowed his walk down to an idler's pace. There were people on the lawn, a mother in a lawn chair, a sleeping baby in her arms, watching 2 kids, maybe 10 and 8, play badminton in grass that was still wet from the rain earlier. The younger of the two, a boy, managed to hit the bird back over the net, and the woman called, "Good one, Sean." The house was the same dark green color, and the fanlight was still over the door, but his mother's flower beds were gone. So, from what he could see, was the jungle gym his father had built from scavenged pipes in the backyard. He remembered the day Georgie had fallen off the top and chipped a tooth. How he had screamed. He saw these things, the ones there and the ones gone, and thought of walking over to the woman with the sleeping baby in her arms. He thought of saying, "Hello, my name is Bill Denbro. I used to live here." And the woman saying, "That's nice." What else could there be? Could he ask her if the face he had carved carefully in one of the attic beams, the face he and Georgie sometimes used to throw darts at, was still there? Could he ask her if her kids sometimes slept on the screened-in back porch when the summer nights were especially hot, talking together in low tones as they watched heat lightning dance on the horizon?
He supposed he might be able to ask some of those things, but he felt he would stutter quite badly if he tried to be charming. And did he really want to know the answers to any of those questions? After Georgie died, it had become a cold house, and whatever he had come back to Derry for was not here. So he went on to the corner and turned right, not looking back. Soon he was on Kansas Street, headed back downtown. He paused for a while at the fence which bordered the sidewalk, looking down into the barrens. The fence was the same rickety wood covered with fading whitewash, and the barrens looked the same, wilder if anything. The only differences he could see were that the dirty smudge of smoke which had always marked the town dump was gone. The dump had been replaced with a modern waste treatment plant, and a long overpass marched across the tangled greenery now, the Turnpike Extension. Everything else was so similar that he might last have seen it the previous summer. Weeds and bushes sloping down to that flat marshy area on the left, and to dense copses of junky scrubby trees on the right. He could see the stands of what they had called bamboo, the silvery white stalks 12 and 14 feet high. He remembered that Richie had once tried to smoke some of it, claiming it was like the stuff jazz musicians smoked and could get you high. All Richie had gotten was sick. Bill could hear the trickle of water running in many small streams, could see the sun heliographing off the broader expanse of the Kanduskeag. And the smell was the same, even with the dump gone. The heavy perfume of growing things at the height of their spring strut did not quite mask the smell of waste and human offal. It was faint but unmistakable. The smell of corruption, a whiff of the underside. "That's where it ended before, and that's where it's going to end this time," Bill thought with a shiver. "In there, under the city." He stood a while longer, convinced that he must see something, some manifestation, of the evil he had come back to Derry to fight. There was nothing. He heard water running, a spring-like and vital sound that reminded him of the dam they had built down there. He could see trees and bushes ruffling in the faint breeze. There was nothing else. No sign. He walked on, dusting a faint whitewash stain from his hands as he went. He kept heading downtown, half-remembering, half-dreaming. And here came another kid, this one a little girl of about 10 in high-waisted corduroy pants and a faded red blouse. She was bouncing a ball with one hand and holding a baby doll by its blonde Arnell hair in the other. "Hey," Bill said. She looked up. "What?" "What's the best store in Derry?" She thought about it. "For me or for anyone?" "For you," Bill said. "Secondhand Rose, secondhand clothes," she said with no hesitation whatsoever.
"I beg your pardon?" Bill asked.
"You beg what?"
"I mean, is that a store name?"
"Sure," she said, looking at Bill as though he might well be enfeebled. "Secondhand Rose, secondhand clothes. My mom says it's a junk shop, but I like it. They have old things, like records you never heard of. Also postcards. It smells like an attic. I have to go home now. Bye."
She walked on, not looking back, bouncing her ball and holding her dolly by the hair.
"Hey,"
he shouted after her. She looked back whimsically.
"I beg your whatchamacallit?"
"The store. Where is it?" She looked back over her shoulder and said,
"Just the way you're going. It's at the bottom of Upmile Hill."
Bill felt that sense of the past folding in on itself, folding in on him. He hadn't meant to ask that little girl anything. The question had popped out of his mouth like a cork flying from the neck of a champagne bottle. He descended Upmile Hill toward downtown. The warehouses and packing plants he remembered from childhood, gloomy brick buildings with dirty windows from which titanic meaty smells issued, were mostly gone, although the Armor and the Star Beef meat packing plants were still there. But Hemp Hill was gone, and there was a drive-in bank and bakery where Eagle Beef and Kosher Meats had been. And there, where the Tracker Brothers Annex had stood, was a sign painted in old-fashioned letters which read, just as the girl with the doll had said, "Secondhand Rose, Secondhand Clothes." The red brick had been painted a yellow which had perhaps been jaunty 10 or 12 years ago, but was now dingy, a color Audra called urine yellow. Bill walked slowly toward it, feeling that sense of déjà vu settle over him again. Later he told the others he knew what ghost he was going to see before he actually saw it. The show window of Secondhand Rose, Secondhand Clothes was more than dingy. It was filthy. No down-east antique shop, this, with nifty little spool beds and Hoosier cabinets and sets of Depression glassware highlighted by hidden spotlights. This was what his mother called with utter disdain a Yankee pawn shop.
The items were strewn in rick-rack profusion, heaped aimlessly here, there, and everywhere. Dresses slumped off coat hangers. Guitars hung from their necks like executed criminals. There was a box of 45 RPM records, 10 cents apiece, the sign read. 12 for a buck. Andrew Sisters, Perry Como, Jimmy Rogers, others. There were kids' outfits and dreadful-looking shoes with a card in front of them which read, Seconds but not bad, $1 a pair. There were two TVs that looked blind. A third was casting bleared images of the Brady Bunch out toward the street. A box of old paperbacks, most with stripped covers, 2 for a quarter, 10 for a dollar, more inside, some hot, sat atop a large radio with a filthy white plastic case and a tuning dial as big as an alarm clock. Bunches of plastic flowers sat in dirty vases on a chipped, gouged, dusty dining room table. All of these things Bill saw as a chaotic background to the thing his eyes had fixed upon immediately. He stood staring at it with wide, unbelieving eyes. Goose flesh ran madly up and down his body. His forehead was hot, his hands cold, and for a moment it seemed that all the doors inside would swing wide and he would remember everything. Silver was in the right-hand window. His kickstand was still gone and rust had flowered on the front and back fenders, but the Uga horn was still there on the handlebars, its rubber bulb now glazed with cracks and age. The horn itself, which Bill had always kept neatly polished, was dull and pitted. The flat package carrier where Richie had often ridden double was still on the back fender, but it was bent now, hanging by a single bolt. At some point, someone had covered the seat with imitation tiger skin, which was now rubbed and frayed to a point where the stripes were almost indistinguishable. Silver. Bill raised an absent hand to wipe away the tears that were running slowly down his cheeks. After he had done a better job with his handkerchief, he went inside. The atmosphere of secondhand rose, secondhand clothes, was musty with age. It was, as the girl had said, an attic smell, but not a good smell, as some attic smells are. This was not the smell of linseed oil rubbed lovingly into the surface of old tables or of ancient plush and velvet. In here was a smell of rotting book bindings, dirty vinyl cushions that had been half-cooked in the hot suns of summers past, dust, mouse turds. From the TV in the window, the Brady Bunch cackled and whooped. Competing with them from somewhere in the back was the radio voice of a disc jockey identifying himself as Your Pal Bobby Russell, promising the new album by Prince to the caller who could give the name of the actor who had played Wally on Leave It to Beaver. Bill knew. It had been a kid named Tony Dow, but he didn't want the new Prince album. The radio was sitting on a high shelf amid a number of 19th century portraits. Below it, and them, sat the proprietor, a man of perhaps 40, who was wearing designer jeans and a fishnet T-shirt. His hair was slicked back, and he was thin to the point of emaciation. His feet were cocked up on his desk, which was piled high with ledgers and dominated by an old scrolled cash register. He was reading a paperback novel which Bill thought had never been nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. It was called Construction Site Studs. On the floor in front of the desk was a barber pole, its stripe revolving up and up into infinity. Its frayed cord wound across the floor to a baseboard plug like a tired snake. The sign in front of it read, A Dying Breed, $250. When the bell over the door jingled, the man behind the desk marked his place with a matchbook cover and looked up. Help you? Yes, Bill said, and opened his mouth to ask about the bike in the window. But before he could speak, his mind was suddenly filled with a single haunting sentence, words that drove away all other thought. He thrusts his fists against the posts and still insists he sees the ghosts. What in the name of God? Thrusts? Looking for anything in particular? The proprietor asked. His voice was polite enough, but he was looking at Bill closely. He's looking at me, Bill thought, amused in spite of his distress, as if he's got an idea I've been smoking some of that stuff that gets the jazz musicians high. Yes, I was interested in his fists against the posts. In that post. The barber pole, you mean? The proprietor's eyes now showed Bill something which, even in his present confused state, he remembered and hated from his childhood. The anxiety of a man or woman who must listen to a stutterer, the urge to jump in quickly and finish the thought, thus shutting the poor bastard up. But I don't stutter. I beat it. I don't fucking stutter. And still insists. The words were so clear in his mind that it seemed someone else must be speaking in there, that he was like a man possessed by demons in biblical times, a man invaded by some presence from outside. And yet he recognized the voice and knew it was his own. He felt sweat pop out warmly on his face.
I could give you...
He sees the ghosts.
A deal on that post, the proprietor was saying. Tell you the truth, I can't move it at 250. I give it to you for 175. How's that? It's the only real antique in the place.
Post.
Pole. Bill almost screamed, and the proprietor recoiled a little. Not the pole I'm interested in.
Are you okay, mister?
The proprietor asked. His solicitous tone belied the expression of hard wariness in his eyes, and Bill saw his left hand leave the desk. He knew, with a flash of something that was really more inductive reasoning than intuition, that there was an open drawer below Bill's own sight line, and that the proprietor had almost surely put his hand on a pistol of some type. He was maybe worried about robbery. More likely, he was just worried. He was, after all, clearly gay, and this was the town where the local juveniles had given Adrian Mellon a terminal bath.
He thrusts his fists against the posts and still insists he sees the ghosts.
It drove out all thought. It was like being insane. Where had it come from?
He thrusts,
repeating and repeating. With a sudden titanic effort, Bill attacked it. He did this by forcing his mind to translate the alien sentence into French. It was the same way he had beaten the stutter as a teenager. As the words marched across his field of thought, he changed them, and suddenly he felt the grip of the stutter loosen. He realized that the proprietor had been saying something.
Pardon me?
I said if you're going to have a fit, take it out on the street. I don't need shit like that in here.
Bill drew in a deep breath.
Let's start over,
he said. Pretend I just came in.
Okay, the proprietor said, agreeably enough. You just came in. Now what?
The bike in the window, Bill said. How much do you want for the bike?
Take $20.
He sounded easier now, but his left hand still hadn't come back into view.
I think it was a Schwinn at one time, but it's a mongrel now.
His eye measured Bill.
Big bike. You could ride it yourself.
Thinking of the kid's green skateboard, Bill said, I think my bike riding days are over. The proprietor shrugged. His left hand finally came up again.
Got a boy?
Yes.
How old is he?
11.
Big bike for an 11-year-old.
Will you take a traveler's check?
Long as it's no more than $10 over the amount of the purchase.
I can give you a 20, Bill said. Mind if I make a phone call?
Not if it's local.
It is.
Be my guest.
Bill called the Derry Public Library. Mike was there.
Where are you, Bill? He asked, and then immediately, are you all right?
I'm fine. Have you seen any of the others?
No, we'll see them tonight.
There was a brief pause.
That is, I presume.
What can I do for you, Big Bill?
I'm buying a bike, Bill said calmly. I wondered if I could wheel it up to your house. Do you have a garage or something I could store it in?
There was silence.
Mike, are you?
I'm here,
Mike said.
Is it silver?
Bill looked at the proprietor. He was reading his book again, or maybe just looking at it and listening carefully.
Yes, he said.
Where are you?
It's called Secondhand Rose, Secondhand Clothes.
All right, Mike said. My place is 61 Palmer Lane. You'd want to go up Main Street.
I can find it.
All right, I'll meet you there. Want some supper?
That would be nice. Can you get off work?
No problem. Carol will cover for me.
Mike hesitated again.
She said that a fellow was in about an hour before I got back here. Said he left looking like a ghost. I got her to describe him. It was Ben.
You sure?
Yeah, and the bike. That's part of it too, isn't it?
Shouldn't wonder,
Bill said, keeping an eye on the proprietor, who still appeared to be absorbed in his book.
I'll see what my place, Mike said. Number 61. Don't forget.
I won't. Thank you, Mike.
God bless, Big Bill.
Bill hung up. The proprietor promptly closed his book again.
Got you some storage space, my friend?
Yeah.
Bill took out his traveler's checks and signed his name to a 20. The proprietor examined the two signatures with a care that, in less distracted mental circumstances, Bill would have found rather insulting.
At last the proprietor scribbled a bill of sale and popped the traveler's check into his old cash register. He got up, put his hands on the small of his back, and stretched, then walked to the front of the store. He picked his way around the heaps of junk and almost junk merchandise with an absent delicacy Bill found fascinating. He lifted the bike, swung it around, and rolled it to the edge of the display space. Bill laid hold of the handlebars to help him, and as he did, another shudder whipped through him.
Silver. Again. It was silver in his hands, and... He thrusts his fists against the posts and still insists he sees the ghosts.
He had to force the thought away because it made him feel faint and strange.
That back tire's a little soft, the proprietor said.
It was, in fact, as flat as a pancake. The front tire was up, but so bald the cord was showing through in places.
No problem, Bill said. You can handle it from here?
I used to be able to handle it just fine. Now I don't know.
I guess so, Bill said. Thanks.
Sure. And if you want to talk about that barber pole, come back.
The proprietor held the door for him. Bill walked the bike out, turned left, and started toward Main Street. People glanced with amusement and curiosity at the man with the bald head pushing the huge bike with the flat rear tire and the Ooga horn protruding over the rusty bike basket, but Bill hardly noticed them. He was marveling at how well his grown-up hands still fitted the rubber hand grips, was remembering how he had always meant to knot some thin strips of plastic, different colors, into the holes in each grip so they would flutter in the wind. He had never gotten around to that. He stopped at the corner of Center and Main, outside of Mr. Paperback. He leaned the bike against the building long enough to strip off his sport coat. Pushing a bike with a flat tire was hard work, and the afternoon had come off hot. He tossed the coat into the basket and went on.
Chain's rusty, he thought. Whoever had it didn't take very good care of
him. It. He stopped for a moment, frowning, trying to remember just what had happened to Silver. Had he sold it, given it away, lost it perhaps? He couldn't remember. Instead, that idiotic sentence, his fists against the posts and still insists, resurfaced, as strange and out of place as an easy chair on a battlefield, a record player in a fireplace, a row of pencils protruding from a cement sidewalk. Bill shook his head. The sentence broke up and dispersed like smoke. He pushed Silver onto Mike's place. 6. Mike Hanlon makes a connection. But first he made supper. Hamburgers with sautéed mushrooms and onions and a spinach salad. They had finished working on Silver by then and were more than ready to eat. The house was a neat little Cape Cod, white with green trim. Mike had just been arriving when Bill pushed Silver up Palmer Lane. He was behind the wheel of an old Ford with rusty rocker panels and a cracked rear window, and Bill remembered the fact Mike had so quietly pointed out. The 6 members of the Losers Club who left Derry had quit being losers. Mike had stayed behind and was still behind. Bill rolled Silver into Mike's garage, which was floored with oiled dirt and was every bit as neat as the house proved to be. Tools hung from pegs, and the lights, shielded with tin cones, looked like the lights which hung over pool tables. Bill leaned the bike against the wall. The two of them looked at it without speaking for a bit, hands in pockets.
"It's Silver, all right," Mike said at last. "I thought you might have been wrong, but it's him. What are you going to do with him?"
"Fucked if I know. Have you got a bicycle pump?"
"Yeah, I think I've got a tire patching kit, too. Are those tubeless tires?"
"They always were."
Bill bent down to look at the flat tire.
"Yeah, tubeless."
"Getting ready to ride it again?"
Of course not, Bill said sharply. "I just don't like to see it's hitting there on a flat."
"Whatever you say, Big Bill. You're the boss."
Bill looked around sharply at that, but Mike had gone to the garage's back wall and was taking down a tire pump. He got a tin tire patching kit from one of the cabinets and handed it to Bill, who looked at it curiously. It was as he remembered such things from his childhood. A small tin box about the same size and shape as those kept by men who roll their own cigarettes, except the top was bright and pebbled. You used it for roughing the rubber around the hole before you put on the patch. The box looked brand new, and there was a Woolco price sticker on it that said $7.23. It seemed to him that when he was a kid, such a kit had gone for about $1.25.
"You didn't just have this hanging around," Bill said.
It wasn't a question.
"No," Mike agreed. "I bought it last week, out at the mall, as a matter of fact."
"You've got a bike of your own?"
"No,
Mike said, meeting his eyes. You just happened to buy this kit.
Just got the urge, Mike agreed, his eyes still on Bill's. Woke up thinking it might come in handy. The thought kept coming back all day. So I got the kit. And here you are to use it.
Here I am to use it, Bill agreed. But like they say on the soaps, what does it all mean, dear?
Ask the others, Mike said, tonight.
Will they all be here, do you think?
I don't know, Big Bill. He paused and added, I think there's a chance that all of them won't be. One or two of them may decide to just creep out of town, or...
He shrugged.
What do we do if that happens?
I don't know. Mike pointed to the tire-patching kit. I paid $7 for that thing. Are you going to do something with it or just look at it?
Bill took his sport coat out of the basket and hung it carefully on an unoccupied wall peg. Then he turned Silver upside down so that he rested on his seat and began to carefully rotate the rear tire. He didn't like the rusty way the axle squeaked, and remembered the almost silent click of the ball bearings in the kid's skateboard.
A little 3-in-1 oil would fix that right up, he thought. Wouldn't hurt to oil the chain either. It's rusty as hell. And playing cards. It needs playing cards on the spokes. Mike would have cards, I bet. The good ones. Bikes, with the cellulite coating that made them so stiff and so slippery that the first time you tried to shuffle them, they always sprayed all over the floor. Playing cards, sure. And clothespins to hold them.
He stopped, suddenly cold.
What in the name of Jesus are you thinking of?
Something wrong, Bill? Mike asked softly.
Nothing. His fingers touched something small and round and hard. He got his nails under it and pulled. A small tack came out of the tire. Here's the culprit, he said, and it rose in his mind again, strange, unbidden, and powerful.
He thrusts his fists against the posts and still insists he sees the ghosts.
But this time the voice, his voice, was followed by his mother's voice saying,
Try again, Billy. You almost had it that time.
And Andy Devine as Guy Madison's sidekick Jingles yelling,
Hey, Wild Bill, wait for me.
He shivered. The posts.
He shook his head.
I couldn't say that without stuttering even now, he thought.
And for just a moment he felt that he was on the edge of understanding it all. Then it was gone. He opened the tire patching kit and went to work. It took a long time to get it just right. Mike leaned against the wall in a bar of late afternoon sun, the sleeves of his shirt rolled up and his tie yanked down, whistling a tune which Bill finally identified as She Blinded Me with Science. While he waited for the tire cement to set, Bill had, just for something to do, he told himself, oiled Silver's chain, sprocket, and axles. It didn't make the bike look any better, but when he spun the tires, he found that the squeak was gone, and that was satisfying. Silver never would have won any beauty contests anyway. His one virtue was that he could go like a blue streak. By that time, 5:30 in the afternoon, he had nearly forgotten Mike was there. He had become completely absorbed in small yet utterly satisfying acts of maintenance. He screwed the nozzle of the pump onto the rear tire's valve and watched the tire fatten, shooting for the right pressure by guess and by gosh. He was pleased to see the patch was holding nicely. When he thought he had it right, he unscrewed the pump nozzle and was about to turn Silver over when he heard the rapid snap flutter of playing cards behind him. He whirled, almost knocking Silver over. Mike was standing there with a deck of blue-backed bicycle playing cards in one hand. Want these? Bill let out a long, shaky sigh.
You've got clothespins, too, I suppose?
Mike took four from the flap pocket of his shirt and held them out.
Just happened to have them around, I suppose.
Yeah, something like that, Mike said. Bill took the cards and tried to shuffle them. His hands shook and the cards sprayed out of his hands. They went everywhere, but only two landed face up. Bill looked at them, then up at Mike. Mike's gaze was frozen on the littered playing cards. His lips had pulled back from his teeth. The two up cards were both the ace of spades.
That's impossible, Mike said. I just opened that deck. Look!
He pointed at the swill can just inside the garage door, and Bill saw the cellophane wrapper.
How can one deck of cards have two aces of spades?
Bill bent down and picked them up.
How can you spray a deck of cards all over the floor and have only two of them land face up? He asked. That's an even better
He turned the aces over, looked, and then showed them to Mike. One of them was a blue back, the other a red back.
Holy Christ, Mikey. What have you got us into?
What are you going to do with those?
Mike asked in a numb voice. Why, put them on, Bill said, and suddenly he began to laugh. That's what I'm supposed to do, isn't it? If there are certain preconditions for the use of magic, those preconditions will inevitably arrange themselves, right? Mike didn't reply. He watched as Bill went to Silver's rear wheel and attached the playing cards. His hands were still shaking, and it took a while, but he finally got it done, drew in one tight breath, held it, and spun the rear wheel. The playing cards machine-gunned loudly against the spokes in the garage's silence.
Come on, Mike said softly. Come on in, Big Bill. I'll make us some chow.
They had scoffed the burgers and now sat smoking, watching dark begin to unfold from dusk in Mike's backyard. Bill took out his wallet, found someone's business card, and wrote upon it the sentence that had plagued him ever since he had seen Silver in the window of Secondhand Rose Secondhand Clothes. He showed it to Mike, who read it carefully, lips pursed.
Does it mean anything to you? Bill asked.
He thrusts his fists against the posts and still insists he sees the ghosts.
He nodded.
Yes, I know what that is.
Well, then tell me. Are you going to give me some more crap about figuring it out for myself?
No, Mike said. In this case, I think it's okay to tell you. The phrase goes back to English times. It's a tongue twister that became a speech exercise for lispers and stutterers. Your mother kept trying to get you to say it that summer, the summer of 1958. You used to go around mumbling it to yourself.
I did?
Bill said, and then slowly, answering his own question,
I did.
You must have wanted to please her very much.
Bill, who suddenly felt he might cry, only nodded. He didn't trust himself to speak.
You never made it, Mike told him. I remember that. You tried like hell, but your tang kept getting all tangled up.
But I did say it, Bill replied, at least once.
When?
Bill brought his fist down on the picnic table hard enough to hurt.
I don't remember,
he shouted. And then dully, he said it again.
I just don't remember.
Chapter 12. Three Uninvited Guests. 1. On the day after Mike Hanlon made his calls, Henry Bowers began to hear voices. Voices had been talking to him all day long. For a while, Henry thought they were coming from the moon. In the late afternoon, looking up from where he was hoeing in the garden, he could see the moon in the blue daytime sky, pale and small, a ghost moon. That, in fact, was why he believed it was the moon that was talking to him. Only a ghost moon would talk in ghost voices. The voices of his old friends, and the voices of those little kids who had played down in the barren so long ago. Those, and another voice, one he did not dare name. Victor Criss spoke from the moon first.
They coming back, Henry. All of them, man. They coming back to Derry.
Then Belch Huggins spoke from the moon, perhaps from the dark side of the moon.
You're the only one, Henry. The only one of us left. You'll have to get 'em for me and Vic. Ain't no little kids can rank us out like that. Why, I hit a ball one time down at Tracker's, and Tony Tracker said that ball would have been out of Yankee Stadium.
He hoed, looking up at the ghost moon in the sky, and after a while Fogarty came over and hit him in the back of the neck and knocked him flat on his face. You're hoeing up the peas right along with the weeds, you idiot. Henry got up, brushing dirt off his face and out of his hair. There stood Fogarty, a big man in a white jacket and white pants, his belly swelled out in front of him. It was illegal for the guards, who were called counselors here at Juniper Hill, to carry billy clubs, so a number of them, Fogarty, Adler, and Kuntz were the worst, carried rolls of quarters in their pockets. They almost always hit you with them in the same place, right in the back of the neck. There was no rule against quarters. Quarters were not considered a deadly weapon at Juniper Hill, an institution for the mentally insane, which stood on the outskirts of Augusta near the Sydney town line.
I'm sorry, Mr. Fogarty, Henry said, and offered a big grin which showed an irregular line of yellow teeth. They looked like the pickets in a fence outside a haunted house.
Henry had begun to lose his teeth when he was 14 or so.
Yeah, you're sorry, Fogarty said. You'll be a lot sorrier if I catch you doing it again, Henry. Yes, sir, Mr. Fogarty.
Fogarty walked away, his black shoes leaving big brown tracks in the dirt of West Garden. Because Fogarty's back was turned, Henry took a moment to look around surreptitiously. They had been shooed out to hoe as soon as the clouds cleared, everyone from the Blue Ward, which was where they put you if you had once been very dangerous, but were now considered only moderately dangerous.
Actually, all the patients at Juniper Hill were considered moderately dangerous. It was a facility for the criminally insane. Henry Bowers was here because he had been convicted of killing his father in the late fall of 1958. It had been a famous year for murder trials, all right. When it came to murder trials, 1958 had been a pip. Only, of course, it wasn't just his father they thought he had killed. If it had only been his father, Henry would not have spent 20 years in the Augusta State Mental Hospital, much of that time under physical and chemical restraint. No, not just his father. The authorities thought he had killed all of them, or at least most of them. Following the verdict, the news had published a front-page editorial titled, "The End of Derry's Long Night." In it, they had recapped the salient points. The belt in Henry's bureau that belonged to the missing Patrick Hochstetter. The jumble of school books, some signed out to the missing Belch Huggins and some to the missing Victor Chris, both known chums of the Bowers boy, in Henry's closet. Most damning of all, the panties found tucked into a slit in Henry's mattress. Panties which had been identified by laundry mark as having belonged to Veronica Grogan, deceased. Henry Bowers, the news declared, had been the monster haunting Derry in the spring and summer of 1958. But then the news had proclaimed the end of Derry's long night on the front page of its December 6th edition, and even an idiot like Henry knew that in Derry, night never ended. They had bullied him with questions, had stood around him in a circle, had pointed fingers at him. Twice the chief of police had slapped him across the face, and once a detective named Lottman had punched him in the gut, telling him to fess up and be quick.
"There's people outside, and they ain't happy, Henry," this Lottman had said. "There ain't been a lynching in Derry for a long time, but that don't mean there couldn't be one."
He supposed they would have kept it up as long as necessary, not because any of them really believed the good Derry folk were going to break into the police station, carry Henry out, and hang him from a sour apple tree, but because they were desperate to close the books on that summer's blood and horror. They would have, but Henry didn't make them. They wanted him to confess to everything. He understood after a while. Henry didn't mind. After the horror in the sewers, after what had happened to Belch and Victor, he didn't seem to mind about anything. Yes, he said, he had killed his father. This was true. Yes, he had killed Victor Chris and Belch Huggins. This was also true, at least in the sense that he had led them into the tunnels where they had been murdered. Yes, he had killed Patrick. Yes, Veronica. Yes, one. Yes, all. Not true, but it didn't matter. Blame needed to be taken. Perhaps that was why he had been spared. And if he refused... He understood about Patrick's belt. He had won it from Patrick playing scat one day in April, discovered it didn't fit, and tossed it in his bureau. He understood about the books, too. Hell, the three of them chummed around together, and they cared no more for their summer textbooks than they had for their regular ones, which is to say, they cared for them about as much as a woodchuck cares for tap dancing. There were probably as many of his books in their closets, and the cops probably knew it, too. The panties. Nope, he didn't know how Veronica Grogan's panties had come to be in his mattress. But he thought he knew who, or what, had taken care of it. Best not to talk about such things. Best to just dummy up. So they sent him to Augusta, and finally, in 1979, they had transferred him to Juniper Hill, and he had only run into trouble once here, and that was because at first no one understood. A guy had tried to turn off Henry's nightlight. The nightlight was Donald Duck doffing his little sailor hat. Donald was protection after the sun went down. With no light, things could come in. The locks on the door and the wire mesh did not stop them. They came like mist. Things. They talked and laughed, and sometimes they clutched. Hairy things, smooth things, things with eyes. The sort of things that had really killed Vic and Belch when the three of them had chased the kids into the tunnels under Derry in August of 1958. Looking around now, he saw the others from the Blue Ward. There was George DeVille, who had murdered his wife and four children one winter night in 1962. George's head was studiously bent, his white hair blowing in the breeze, snot running gaily out of his nose, his huge wooden crucifix bobbing and dancing as he hoed. There was Jimmy Donlan, and all they said in the papers about Jimmy was that he had killed his mother in Portland during the summer of 1965. But what they hadn't said in the papers was that Jimmy had tried a novel experiment in body disposal. By the time the cops came, Jimmy had eaten more than half of her, including her brains. "They may be twice as smart," Jimmy had confided to Henry one night after lights out.
In the row beyond Jimmy, hoeing fanatically and singing the same line over and over, as always, was the little Frenchman, Benny Beaulieu. Benny had been a firebug, a pyromaniac. Now as he hoed, he sang this line from the Doors over and over. Try to set the night on fire. Try to set the night on fire. Try to set the night on fire. Try to... It got on your nerves after a while. Beyond Benny was Franklin DeCruz, who had raped over 50 women before being caught with his pants down in Bangor's Terrace Park. The ages of his victims ranged from 3 to 81. Not very particular was Frank DeCruz. Beyond him, but way back, was Arlen Weston, who spent as much time looking dreamily at his hoe as he did using it. Fogarty, Adler, and John Koontz had all tried the roll of quarters in the fist trick on Weston to try and convince him he could move a bit faster. And one day Koontz had hit him maybe a little too hard because blood came not only from Arlen Weston's nose, but also from Arlen's ears. And that night he had a convulsion. Not a big one, just a little one. But since then Arlen had drifted further and further into his own interior blackness, and now he was a hopeless case, almost totally unplugged from the world. Beyond Arlen was...
You want to pick it up or I'll give you some more help, Henry?
Fogarty bawled over and Henry began to hoe again. He didn't want any convulsions. He didn't want to end up like Arlen Weston. Soon the voices started in again, but this time they were the voices of the others, the voices of the kids that had gotten him into this in the first place, whispering down from the ghost moon.
You couldn't even catch a fat boy, Bowers, one of them whispered. Now I'm rich and you're hoeing peas. Ha ha, and you, asshole. Bowers, you couldn't catch a cold. Read any good books since you've been into there? I wrote lots. I'm rich and you're in Judge Juniper Hill. Ha ha, and you stupid asshole.
Shut up, Henry whispered to the ghost voices, hoeing faster, beginning to hoe up the new pea plants along with the weeds. Sweat rolled down his cheeks like tears.
We could have taken you. We could have. We got you locked up, you asshole,
another voice laughed.
You chased me and couldn't catch me, and I got rich, too. Way to go, banana heels.
Shut up, Henry muttered, hoeing faster. Just shut up.
Did you want to get in my panties, Henry?
Another voice teased.
Too bad. I let all of them do me. I was nothing but a slut. But now I'm rich, too, and we're all together again, and we're doing it again, but you couldn't do it now, even if I let you, because you couldn't get it up. So ha-ha on you, Henry. Ha-ha all over you.
He hoed madly, weeds and dirt and pea plants flying. The ghost voices from the ghost moon were very loud now, echoing and flying in his head, and Fogarty was running toward him, bellowing, but Henry could not hear, because of the voices.
Couldn't even get hold of a nigger like me, could you?
Another jeering ghost voice chimed in.
We killed you guys in that rock fight. We fucking killed you. Ha-ha, asshole. Ha-ha all over you.
Then they were all babbling together, laughing at him, calling him banana heels, asking him how he'd liked the shock treatments they'd given him when he came up here to the Red Ward, asking him if he liked it here at Judge Juniper Hill, asking and laughing, laughing and asking, and Henry dropped his hoe and began to scream up at the ghost moon in the blue sky, and at first he was screaming in fury. And then the moon itself changed and became the face of the clown, its face a rotted, pocked, cheesy white, its eyes black holes, its red, bloody grin turned up in a smile so obscenely ingenuous that it was insupportable. And so then Henry began to scream not in fury but in mortal terror, and the voice of the clown spoke from the ghost moon now, and what it said was,
"You have to go back, Henry. You have to go back and finish the job. You have to go back to Derry and kill them all, for me, for..."
Then Fogarty, who had been standing nearby and yelling at Henry for almost 2 minutes, while the other inmates stood in their rows, hoes grasped in their hands like comic phalluses, their expressions not exactly interested, but almost, yes, almost thoughtful, as if they understood that this was all a part of the mystery that had put them here, that Henry Bowers's sudden attack of the screaming memes in West Garden was interesting in some more than technical way. Got tired of shouting and gave Henry a real blast with his quarters, and Henry went down like a ton of bricks, the voice of the clown following him down into that terrible whirlpool of darkness, chanting over and over again,
"Kill them all, Henry, kill them all, kill them all, kill them all."
2. Henry Bowers lay awake. The moon was down, and he felt a sharp sense of gratitude for that. The moon was less ghostly at night, more real.
And if he should see that dreadful clown face in the sky, riding over the hills and fields and woods, he believed he would die of terror. He lay on his side, staring at his nightlight intently. Donald Duck had burned out. He had been replaced by Mickey and Minnie Mouse dancing a polka. They had been replaced with the green, glowing face of Oscar the Grouch from Sesame Street. And late last year, Oscar had been replaced by the face of Fozzie Bear. Henry had measured out the years of his incarceration with burned-out nightlights instead of coffee spoons. At exactly 2:04 a.m. on the morning of May 30th, his nightlight went out. A little moan escaped him. No more. Coots was on the door of the Blue Ward tonight. Coots, who was the worst of the lot. Worse even than Fogarty, who had hit him so hard in the afternoon that Henry could barely turn his head. Sleeping around him were the other Blue Ward inmates. Benny Bolu slept in elastic restraints. He had been allowed to watch an emergency rerun on the wardroom TV when they came in from hoeing, and around 6 o'clock had begun jerking off constantly and without let-up, screaming, "Try to set the night on fire! Try to set the night on fire! Try to set the night on fire!" He had been sedated, and that was good for about 4 hours. And then he had started in again around 11 when the Elleville wore off, whipping his old dingus so hard it had started to bleed through his fingers, shrieking, "Try to set the night on fire!" So they sedated him again and put him in restraints. Now he slept, his pinched little face as grave in the dim light as Aristotle's. From around his bed, Henry could hear low snores and loud ones, grunts, and occasional bed fart. He could hear Jimmy Donlan's breathing. It was unmistakable, even though Jimmy slept 5 beds over, rapid and faintly whistling. For some reason, it always made Henry think of a sewing machine. From beyond the door, giving on the hall, he could hear the faint sound of Kuntz's TV. He knew that Kuntz would be watching the late movies on Channel 38, drinking Texas Driver and eating his lunch. Kuntz favored sandwiches made out of chunky peanut butter and Bermuda onions. When Henry heard this, he had shuddered and thought, "And they say all the crazy people are locked up." This time the voice didn't come from the moon. This time it came from under the bed. Henry recognized the voice at once. It was Victor Criss, whose head had been torn off somewhere beneath Derry 27 years ago. It had been torn off by the Frankenstein monster. Henry had seen it happen, and afterward he had seen the monster's eyes shift and had felt its watery yellow gaze on him. Yes, the Frankenstein monster had killed Victor, and then it had killed Belch. But here was Vic again, like the almost ghostly rerun of a black-and-white program from the nifty 50s when the president was bald and the Buicks had portholes. And now that it had happened, now that the voice had come, Henry found that he was calm and unafraid, relieved even.
"Henry,"
Victor said.
"Vic," Henry cried, "what are you doing under there?"
Benny Bolu snorted and muttered in his sleep. Jimmy's neat nasal sewing machine inhales and exhales paused for a moment. In the hall, the volume on Kuntz's small Sony was turned down, and Henry Bowers could sense him, head cocked to one side, one hand on the TV's volume knob, the fingers of the other hand touching the cylinder which bulged in the right-hand pocket of his whites, the roll of quarters.
"You don't have to talk out loud, Henry," Vic said. "I can hear you if you just think, and they can't hear me at all."
"What do you want, Vic?" Henry asked.
There was no reply for a long time. Henry thought that maybe Vic had gone away. Outside the door, the volume of Kuntz's TV went up again. Then there was a scratching noise from under the bed. The spring squealed slightly as a dark shadow pulled itself out from under. Vic looked up at him and grinned. Henry grinned back uneasily. Old Vic was looking a little bit like the Frankenstein monster himself these days. A scar like a hang-rope tattoo circled his neck. Henry thought maybe that was where his head had been sewed back on. His eyes were a weird gray-green color, and the corneas seemed to float on a watery, viscous substance. Vic was still 12.
"I want the same thing you want," Vic said. "I want to pay him back."
"Pay him back," Henry Bowers said dreamily.
"But you'll have to get out of here to do it," Vic said. "You'll have to go back to Derry. I need you, Henry. We all need you."
"They can't hurt you," Henry said, understanding he was talking to more than Vic.
"They can't hurt me if they only half believe," Vic said. "But there have been some distressing signs, Henry. We didn't think they could beat us back then, either.
But the fat boy got away from you in the Barrens. The fat boy and the smart mouth and the quiff got away from us that day after the movies. And the rock fight, when they saved the nigger.
Don't talk about that, Henry shouted at Vic. And for a moment, all of the peremptory hardness that had made him their leader was in his voice.
Then he cringed, thinking Vic would hurt him. Surely Vic could do whatever he wanted, since he was a ghost. But Vic only grinned.
I can take care of them if they only half believe, he said. But you're alive, Henry. You can get them no matter if they believe, half believe, or don't believe at all. You can get them one by one or all at once. You can pay them back.
Pay them back, Henry repeated. Then he looked at Vic doubtfully again.
But I can't get out of here, Vic. There's wire on the windows and Kuntz is on the door tonight. Kuntz is the worst. Maybe tomorrow night.
Don't worry about Kuntz, Vic said, standing up. Henry saw he was still wearing the jeans he had been wearing that day, and that they were still splattered with drying sewer muck.
I'll take care of Kuntz.
Vic held out his hand. After a moment, Henry took it. He and Vic walked toward the Blue Ward door and the sound of the TV. They were almost there when Jimmy Donlan, who had eaten his mother's brains, woke up. His eyes widened as he saw Henry's late-night visitor. It was his mother. Her slip was showing just a quarter inch or so, as it always had. The top of her head was gone. Her eyes, horribly red, rolled toward him, and when she grinned, Jimmy saw the lipstick smears on her yellow horsey teeth, as he always had. Jimmy began to shriek, "No, Ma! No, Ma! No, Ma!"